This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 18th day of September 2010. And today I'm talking to Douglas Lane, the author of the book Last Week's Apocalypse, as well as Billy Moon 1968, forthcoming from Tor Books, and Pick Your Battle, forthcoming from Eberhardt Press. He also hosts two podcasts, a Diet Soap podcast and 1,000 Words Talking Art. Douglas Lane, thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, Doug, for those listeners who might be encountering you for the first time, tell us a little bit about yourself and what your background.
Well, I'm a fiction writer, a short story writer primarily, but I've written a couple of novels, and I'm also a podcaster. I do the Diet Soap podcast every week, and I'm an unschooling dad, so the 1,000 Words Talking Art podcast, which is currently on hiatus, but which I did three episodes of. It's something I do with my oldest son. It's sort of an unschooling project to teach and learn about avant-garde art or modern art from the 19th to the century to the 21st century.
Well, that sounds interesting. Unschooling, I suppose, being a form of homeschooling?
That's right, yeah. Unschooling is basically homeschooling for the disorganized.
Sounds nice.
Yeah, it's truly actually it's self-directed homeschooling. So you encourage and support your children's interests, but you don't necessarily have a curriculum. You know, homeschooling, often what people do is they recreate the institution of school at home. And an unschooling approach is one where you try not to do that, where you rely more on self-directed learning and kind of projects, project-based learning rather than any set curriculum.
Well, that is a fascinating concept and one that I think it would behoove my listeners to learn more about. What would a typical day for an unschooler actually look like?
Well, it depends on which one of my kids you're talking about. For my oldest son, a typical day might include digging a hole in the front yard to create a bog. He's trying to create a bog for his carnivorous plants. It would include doing some work in the backyard with some carnivorous plants he has there, probably playing video games on the computer, going for a walk down to the wetlands, going to the library to get books, these days almost exclusively on carnivorous plants. It's kind of almost obsessive compulsive with him right now. I catch him in the kitchen, like talking to and petting his like Venus flytrap. It's a little bizarre, actually, the depth of his love of these plants. But he's some scientific books on the subject, or seemingly scientific, more scientific than I am anyway. He knows all their Latin names and such. For Emma, it's my daughter. She's more likely to be just doing some reading, maybe novels and such, and going to a drama group or going to see her friends. And, you know, to be honest, I'm like either trapped in my office or out somewhere trying to write. So Miriam, my wife, is a little bit more involved and knows all their projects a little better than I do. But wherever their day takes them, whatever kind of projects or interests they're developing is what their day will include. And until I come along and try to force them to learn philosophy or whatever it is, or avant-garde art.
Well, that is an interesting concept, and one of the reasons that I wanted to get you on today is to talk about another interesting concept that you've been talking about recently, and that's the idea of abundant cities. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about this idea and what you're trying to hit on with it.
Well, the first thing is I've been doing some wandering as part of this book project, Pick Your Battle, and to a large extent, that's been the primary thing I've done for the book, which is just going into my neighborhood, into my community, and finding what kind of plants, edible plants, are already out there. And in a sense, if you are looking to supplement your diet or, you know, find some blackberries or something, we already live in abundant cities. There's a lot of fruit growing in my neighborhood. Basically, if you live in Portland anyway, you're already in an abundant city because, you know, there's so much fruit growing that's just going to waste. I see apple trees where, you know, half the tree is on the sidewalk, all these rotten apples on the sidewalk, or blackberry bushes where the blackberries are all shriveled up and dried up because no one's come along to pick them. And even, you know, I've been making the effort to get out there and collect these things, but I can't collect them all. If I tried to collect them all, my wife would kick me out of the house. I mean, there's so much out there that's just already going to waste. But the idea of an abundant city is one where it wouldn't go to waste, and you would consciously grow more fruit trees, more blackberry bushes, more raspberry bushes, more edible plants throughout the city that everyone has open access to. That basically the goal of a truly abundant city is one where the agricultural projects in the city are communal. It's open to anyone to partake of the fruits and to give their labor. And that's the idea of an abundant city. It's kind of an anarchist concept. I read about it, probably 20 years ago almost, in some anarchist magazine, maybe the Fifth Estate. But this vision is to create cities where the food isn't under lock and key, or at least a good portion of it isn't, where your civic projects include creating edible plants, fruit trees, lining the streets with them, filling the parks with them, so that everyone, so no one goes hungry. And also so that people are more free, because if you don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from, or at least where your next apple is coming from, you're less likely to get stuck in a wage relationship.
Well, that's exactly right. And to me, that strikes me as the exact point, is that unfortunately, this is a revolutionary concept in the system that we're living in, but it really shouldn't be. It should be a common sense concept that we should build communities around the concept of growing and sharing food and making sure that everybody is able to eat. But unfortunately, we've grown up in these environments where we're dependent on supermarkets and mass industrial food production. And it's just such a travesty in so many ways. So I guess the inevitable question is, how do we get from where we are as a society to the abundant city concept?
Well, you can get to some version of the abundant city concept without really getting out from underneath the real problem. I mean, so for instance, you could easily enough start an initiative process, say, and I could do it in Portland too, get more civic resources going towards planting fruit trees and just creating groves inside the city. And that would be a step towards an abundant city. But what you're really asking is, how do we get to a point where we're sharing not just food, but most of what we produce on a communal basis? And that is a problem which I don't have an easy answer to. Some of the big experiments in that direction in the past haven't turned out so well, like, say, Communist China or Soviet Union. And and getting to a point where we can cooperate and share the resources, I think it's going to be a struggle. I think that it's going to struggle in both directions. One is to kind of get out from under the current capitalist system we're in, and another is to develop some sort of democratic, decentralized form of communism or communalism.
Right. Well, exactly. It has to be voluntary. It can't be coercive. And to some extent, perhaps it's utopian to think that we'll ever get to that point as a society, but surely there must be a better balance that we can strike than what we have today. And I think there are so many people who are interested in this concept, but can't find the time to get involved or don't want to start such a project because it seems overwhelming in the society that we're living in. So I guess some people might be lacking motivation for this.
You know, I think of it like this. It's not that it has to be voluntary so much as that it has to be, that everyone has to be equally politically empowered to be coercive. In other words, social relationships are coercive relationships. If you have kids or even just friends, there's always this give and take. There's always a bit of coercion. It's just how level that playing field is going to be.
Right, exactly. So I guess what we're talking about more is sort of a communal consensus type concept where there's actual direct, sort of direct democracy type input into each decision that's being made.
Right, and one of the big things that's helpful is about the permaculture movement and movements for kind of localizing the economy is that there's this emphasis on the human scale, which I think is really positive because the kind of coercion you find amongst people who are living in a community that's on the human scale tends to be mitigated, you know. But when you're dealing with people face to face, when you know each other as people, full, well-rounded people, you know, you might exploit someone. There might be some exploitive relationships, and you're going to have to change the structure of the town or to really get to the root of the problem. But you at least have some human basis for trying to create a better structure.
I think that's so right, and that's hits, I think, so fundamentally on one of the key points of the way that the structure that we're living in is controlling us right now, and that's because so much of what our decision-making and so much of the powers that rule us have become so centralized in such faraway locations and made by representatives who really don't represent us that I think we've lost all concept of what it means to have that type of community decision-making.
Yeah, but the kind of strange flip side of that is that if you are going out to try to build a community, if you want to get to know your neighbors, if you want to turn to the human scale, what you find right away is that your desire to do that is not in and of itself going to get rid of the structures that keep that from forming or that disempower those kinds of communities. Because, you know, the reality is I may know my neighbor and love my neighbor, but my neighbor doesn't really matter to me because I don't live in an economy where my neighbor can matter. I live in an economy that's global and abstracted, and unless I do something about that big global economy, the big system, whatever I work out on a small scale, at the very best going to be a subculture, and only will be available to a few people, or it's just going to be, you know, something I do in my leisure time, like any other hobby. And I think that's one of the things about friendships in this society, is that they're really... they're not central to producing our lives. That's why they're kind of debased. That's why people aren't very good friends some of the time, because we don't need each other. We've set up a system where we don't need each other.
Yes, that is right. But I guess the question is, can baby steps be a transformative way of getting to where we want to be, or does it have to be a complete revolution all at once?
I don't know. I hope that baby steps can do it. But I think in order to do that, even to take baby steps in the right direction, you have to do some really serious thinking about what direction you're trying to go in. I don't know the answer. What do you tell me? What do you think? Do you think baby steps can get us there?
I think fundamentally I have to believe that, because I don't think that any great revolutionary movement ever ends up in anything other than a new form of tyranny. I think it just always tends to evolve to that state, and I think that instead of taking that approach, I think we have to take a longer-term view of things, because I don't think our society was engineered into what it is today overnight, and I don't think it'll be turned into something that we want to see overnight. It's a process of really educating people and starting... just starting small steps that I think will eventually lead to where we want to go. And I think, I don't know if that's utopian to think that, but it's certainly what I...
See, I'm not as cynical as you are about revolutionary moments, but I do know what you're talking about when you say that these things have led to tyranny, that revolutionary movements have led to their own tyrannies. But I look to some examples which weren't ultimately successful, but which didn't lead to their own tyrannies either. Maybe the reason why was because they weren't successful. But I look to historical moments like the Paris Commune, or also in Paris, more recently in May 1968, or even to some degree the Russian Revolution before it was kind of turned on its head by the Bolsheviks, as moments where people have worked to try to reoccupy their lives and create a new structure. But the fact that these things have failed, And especially for the most recent one, May 68, which I've done the most research into, the way in which those movements have failed, I think, are really important to understand, because I don't think that we can do baby steps and gradually, and I think there's going to be a rupture point. If you really are doing baby steps towards something, I think there's going to be a point of confrontation, and there has to be a lot of solidarity in the face of that confrontation. But before you get there, you got to know what you're walking into. So like in May 1968, what happened was the students occupied the universities. Young workers in the factories occupied the factories in solidarity, because basically in a reaction to the police violence against the students. This grew in a matter of weeks to 10 million people all across France on strike, including the television reporters, including taxi cab drivers. All walks of life were on strike. And there was a revolutionary sense that they could democratize the economy and the nation in a new way. It wasn't, it didn't have the feeling of the, the old Soviet-style revolution. It wasn't that they were trying to contest. They weren't trying to go occupy the castle, They were taking their lives. They were taking their own factories, their own universities, their own taxi cabs, and running them for themselves. It was put down, but it was put down through a referendum, through propaganda. But it's important to note what was attempted and how it was attempted and what was successful about it.
Well, yeah, that's right. But I guess the modern day version of storming the castle in a industrial society would be to storm the factories and to take over the taxi cabs and all the other things that help lubricate the industrial society. But I see what you're saying, and I do agree that taking baby steps will eventually lead to a point where there will have to be a fundamental change. But rather than a rupture point, I'd posit as something of a tipping point, where by the example that has been set in a certain community or by a certain group of people will itself start to catch on as an idea. And I think once it becomes that sort of viral, almost like a meme or something, spreading throughout the society, then it's not a question of any human sort of will that's making it happen so much as just, I guess, the idea itself spreading because people have seen how effective it is. Or I think that's the ideal that I would tend to posit.
Right. The only thing I would add to that, I think you're right about that. I like that model of the idea spreading amongst people and people working together in a cooperative way, bit by bit, as kind of this idea of a communal-based life spreads. But the only thing I add to that is, while that's going on, we're under attack. Our day-to-day lives are less stable than ever, and it's because of the institutions of power that exist. So we can't expect that this is that our struggle to form a better life is going to happen in a vacuum. It's going to happen basically, not to be too Marxist about it, but in a class war that's already being waged. I mean, just the banking scandal, really. The banker bailout that happened 2 years ago is a really prime example of how we, as a people, are being undermined in order to prop up the institutions of power that already exist. And that they can't continue, actually, without basically robbing us. That's why they're doing it. It's not that they're that the bankers or the capitalist class wants to immiserate the population. It's just that we've reached a point where, in order to hold on to their power, that is necessary.
Well, I agree, and I think, unfortunately, I think they do want to immiserate the population. I think that is actually part of their mindset and their ideology right now. But just a minor, like a small-scale version of this, it comes from actually a recent news story from Georgia, where a county is actually suing a man for growing too many vegetables and fruits on his property and then attempting to give them away or sell them at the farmer's market. And they're actually saying that his property isn't properly zoned for that, so they're actually bringing a lawsuit against him. So it's kind of amazing. But yes, you're certainly right. We are under a coordinated attack, and it is going to continue happening even as we do take these baby steps.
Right. And, you got absolutely have to defend that guy who's trying to grow his own food and help him out when the state clamps down on him. But I think that the bigger issue right now is not really about home gardening. I think that that's kind of a small, I haven't seen that as a major trend that kind of pops up here and there. But the big issue is about foreclosure and all these, and how so many people are being forced out of their homes and working with people to occupy their own homes as a step towards holding on to their community and holding on to their lives and occupying their lives. So what I guess I'm saying is that if my neighbor was attacked by the county for growing too many vegetables, I would probably just increase the number of vegetables in my own garden and try to organize some symbolic protest against that. And I think that it would be pretty fair, easy to succeed with that. People are outraged by that. But people are also outraged by foreclosures. But it just is seen as being so big, it's almost unbeatable. And that's where I think we got to kind of get our courage up. But, you know, I when I say that kind of thing, it sounds like I have easy answers, and I don't. And the reason I'm writing this book about my own neighborhood is because I think one of the things you have to do that I'm trying to do and I haven't completed is figure out just how your own thinking is limited and how the way you live on a daily basis limits your thinking. So just for me, walking my own neighborhood and kind of getting a feel for my actual physical environment and has been eye-opening and interesting, and I think it's worth doing.
Well, again, I think unfortunately in our modern society, even such an action like that can be seen as somewhat revolutionary, because it is so against the norm to actually go out and explore your own community. It's almost, you know, unbelievable.
Right. Well, and you know what? If you do it, what I noticed was that I felt like I was trespassing a good portion of the time, walking down streets that my house isn't on, and not knowing anyone in that area. And especially when I was with my son and I would stop and point to an interesting house or an interesting yard or what have you, I felt like I was violating people's privacy. And that's not because anyone... That's because of the way we zone residential areas. It's not because of the people who live in those houses, but it's the way that we push all these houses together and create these little tiny boxes of private space with no public space left in them. There's no room for community in our residential streets. I mean, you need like a library or a cafe or a local grocery store or a communal garden or some place which isn't a privately owned home. In order for communities to happen.
That's right. But unfortunately, Google has no compunction about people's privacy, so they're happy to cruise up and down streets and take photos and scan your Wi-Fi.
Right.
And, that's true, though. It certainly does create that sort of that feeling that there is this private space that you just can't really enter into unless you have a reason to be there. And it does create that mindset. So certainly, I think the way that our communities are physically laid out has such a psychological effect on us.
Yeah, I think it does. And that's just like the very grossest, most obvious kind of surface read of it. I mean... as I wander more and I go out again, I notice more details about it. Like, so for instance, in my neighborhood, in Portland, actually, there's an urban forest project, which I, on the surface, would support. Could plant a lot of trees. It's great for it's good for the air. It's good. It makes the city more beautiful. But what it also does is cover up the social relationships that are going on. So if you're driving through, you kind of feel like you're out in nature or you're in almost this utopian neighborhood, but you don't notice all the wires that are running through and also all the fences and that first level read, you know, how everyone's cut off from one another. So it's like we have this veneer of greenery over pretty much a space that's as alienated as any inner city neighborhood. You know, like if you strip those trees away, it would still just be concrete and fences, really. And that's important to notice too. It's kind of some of the facades that are up there.
Right. Well, okay. Well, not to complicate things too much, but I understand that you also tie situationist philosophy into this. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I'm pointing to with when I'm talking about the walking and the wandering. The situationists were, for people who don't know, they were artists and revolutionaries in France in the 50s and 60s. And they were involved in the May 68 strikes. But before that, they were mostly artists and theorists. And one of their major tools to fight the exploitation and capitalist system that they were a part of was to wander Paris and create new maps of Paris based on the psychogeography or the psychological ambiance of different neighborhoods. So I've been using that wandering technique to get a sense of my own neighborhood. And what you do is when you're doing one of these situationist wanders, or these what they call a derive, is you let the built environment you're in direct your walk. So you're not aiming to go any particular place, but trying to react to the architecture and the layout of the city or the neighborhood. And in my neighborhood, in the Woodstock neighborhood of Portland, what I found is that it's such a grid that you feel very much directed like an electron through a circuit or something. It doesn't flow very much. Yet you have to kind of get closer into the city center to kind of get breathing room. Actually, I discovered that when I would get into more industrial areas and areas where there are more commercial buildings or bars, I could breathe easier because there was more space for me as someone who wasn't going home, you know, when I was in these areas. But yeah, so that's the situationist technique, is this wandering. The situationist theory was that we live in a society of the spectacle where everything is presented to us as an image that we can't ever get our hands on. So the world, the political world especially, is something we watch but don't influence or impact. Basically, as consumers or spectators, we consume or watch the world, but we don't influence it. We have no means to influence our built environment.
Right, and imagine how much more true that is, you know, 60 years after the situationists came along. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely just so apparent now, I think, but it must have been a somewhat interesting idea back in that day.
Well, you know, they were dealing with the arrival of television, and they were dealing with an ascendant America at that time, and popular culture as we know it was being born around the time that they were starting their projects. So it wasn't like it was invisible to people then. But now, in fact, maybe the fact that it wasn't so pervasive made it more visible to people then. Because now you talk about the spectacle, and you know, it's either people don't see it at all because it's like the air they breathe, or you're just talking about the most obvious thing in the world, and why even bother to mention it? Yeah.
It's true. And we've been under, I think, a type of psychic attack for the last 50 years, where it went from the 1960 presidential debate, which many people say was won because Kennedy was more photogenic, right, to having an actual actor as the president in the 1980s,
right,
then to having, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger as the governor of California, and then topping it all off with the Obama campaign of hope and change, which actually convinced people that Obama was going to descend from the clouds and, I guess, I don't know, touch them and they'd be healed from all their worldly cares or something.
Well, I mean, if you scratch the surface with people who were Obama supporters, maybe people who are older than 20, what you find are people who have only a rough idea of what FDR did, thinking that Obama was going to be the next FDR. And he has done nothing in that direction at all. But I think that is a kind of a feeling that dies hard. You know, it's a hope that, while mostly gone, is still kind of floating around out there amongst diehard Democrats and liberals. But Yeah, he was certainly, he wasn't a disappointment to me, but he was, he certainly lived up to my worst expectations.
Yes, unfortunately. Well, exactly. I think you might even overestimate the sort of political philosophy of the diehard Obama supporters. I don't think there was even that much to it. I think it was truly just a generated phenomenon that was just a spectacle. It was completely in the realm of the spectacle and had nothing to do with political philosophy at all. It was just vague terms that I guess pushed the right buttons at the right time.
Yeah, you may be right for a good portion of the people, but it certainly worked that way on television. Well, let's put it this way. If you were someone who thought that he was going to be the next FDR, you should have been disabused of that idea as soon as he supported the banker bailouts, as soon as he stepped forward and made sure that TARP went through against the will of the Congress. When he did that, he was exposing himself to have nothing in common, at least with the popular conceptions of FDR, right? He was siding with Wall Street over Main Street. He was going to take the federal monies to prop up these private institutions. And what could have turned been money that could have been, or resources that could have been turned towards maybe softening the blow of an economic recession or depression was instead, you know, turned over basically to line the pockets of these, the most wealthy individuals in our society.
Well, exactly. And especially when it came out before the election, when McCain and Obama appeared together to say, we both support the bailout and it's great and it's going to save everyone. I think that was should have been a defining moment for many people who didn't know the
right
sort of bigger agenda.
So the way the spectacle works is it isn't like you're mindless. It's just like your thoughts don't relate to, they only relate to the image on the screen. So people somehow, despite that, held on to this notion that he was the next FDR and that once he got into office, he was going to do something different than what he had already done during his campaign. So I don't think that people didn't have any analysis at all. It's people who I knew did, but they had their feelings or hopes for him as to what he would do that were completely detached from anything that he did, because what was most important about him, the thing that those hopes were based on, was his image and not his policies or actions. And, you know, this is the whole thing about running on basically on personality rather than, and it's what's behind the Tea Party movement too, because, you know, you have a few figures who are kind of charismatic in the Tea Party movement, but more than that, you have images of populist rage, but they don't attach themselves to any actual policy or politics. And to the extent they do attach themselves to politics, just like Obama, they're actually usually the reverse of what people want.
You know? I agree completely with that in the way that the Tea Party is now, but I think that the Tea Party actually stemmed from the 9/11 Truth Movement and then was picked up by Ron Paul, which I think did have a sort of revolutionary political moment to it. And unfortunately, I think it was co-opted by the Republicans. But
I kind of followed the 9/11 Truth Movement. When did the Tea Party start emerging from the Truth Movement?
It was either 2005 or 2006. I believe it was 2006, and Boston 9/11 Truth had a throwing the 9/11 Commission report in the Boston Harbor, and they called it the Boston Tea Party. And from that, it became sort of an annual movement.
Yeah, you know, I was aware. I remember when that happened. I just never put that together because once Glenn Beck started being
exactly
involved in the Tea Party, I just figured it was that he was perverting.
Exactly, and that was obviously a perversion of it, but it stemmed from the 9/11 Truth Movement thing to becoming a Ron Paul support thing, which obviously there was some overlap between those two movements in the 2008 election, and from that it was then corrupted by the Glenn Becks and all that.
The thing about let's talk about the 9/11 Truth Movement for a minute, because I think that the 9/11 Truth Movement itself can be a kind of spectacle. Not that I definitely am someone who does not believe the official story about 9/11, but that because even before 9/11 happened, there was a conspiracy industry. There was a conspiracy theories as a form of entertainment that already existed, that it was pretty easy for what should have been a political movement which had legs and demands, you know, wanted demands beyond just an official investigation or demands beyond even what happened on 9/11, but basically wanting to change the way politics works so that these kinds of conspiracies could never arise. Demands for transparency, demands for decentralization of power, for curbing police excesses and military excesses, for changing foreign policies. All of these things should have been, and which are to some degree part of the 9/11 truth movement, but what is ascendant with the 9/11 truth movement is this image of the conspiracy, which you can find out about, just like you can find out about, you know, the right kind of, basically it's kind of a snake oil approach to politics. It's surface and no deeper. And I think that the thing is, once you start going into any one of these subjects, you're going to run the danger of turning into your image, turning into a spectacle just by trying to engage it. So I'm not like pointing fingers at any 9/11 truth activists, but I do think that there was a whole dynamic and industry around conspiracy theories, which is spectacular.
Right. I understand completely what you're saying, and sometimes I even wonder about the Corbett Report and what I'm doing and whether people are accepting it as some form of entertainment rather than just an example of what people should, I think, be doing in trying to spread information. And right. I do worry about that really sometimes, and I wonder if it's even worth continuing if people do just expect a sort of weekly podcast as something they can tune into and it'll be, you know, entertaining for an hour and then they can go back to their daily life.
Well, and you know, then, and no matter who you are, you can do that. I mean, if you're Noam Chomsky or you're Doug Lane with the Diet Soap podcast, you know, it's very easy to turn your politics into an identity and then turn that identity into an entertainment which you just consume. So You are an anarchist. And how do you know you're an anarchist? Well, you read the right books, you wear the right t-shirts,
Exactly.
You listen to the right podcast, and it doesn't have any impact on how you actually live. And there again, what I'm talking about is this larger conspiracy of the spectacle, which is so pervasive, which we have to think hard about getting around. And I don't think easy answers like, oh, I just won't do the Corbett Report. It's, you know, obviously that's not a good answer. Or I won't do the Diet Soap podcast. That's not a good answer. But I frankly feel like for a good portion of times, I'm not even really asking the right questions about these things. So I think one of the good things about podcasting is that it gets people like you and me together to ask questions of each other and to try to think in new ways we wouldn't be able to, in ways we wouldn't be able to think if we weren't talking to each other, if we were just on our own.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. And in fact, this is one of the more philosophical conversations I've had recently. So I'd like to thank you for that. And and certainly I'd hope we can do this again and connect again in the future. But why don't you tell people a little bit about what you're working on and when it might be released?
Okay. Well, I'm writing the Pick Your Battle book. And it's not coming out from Eberhardt Press, but it's going to be printed by them. I'm pretty much the publisher of this one because I funded it on Kickstarter, which is an online creative funding platform. I got a bunch of people to donate, actually 165 people donated to the writing and the printing of this book. So it's already fully funded. And I'm going to be printing it in mid-October or late October. I'm writing it now. If you are interested in it, you can go to the Diet Soap podcast and just listen to some recent episodes because I've been reading excerpts of what I'm writing at the conclusion. Sorry, I had to cough there. So it's underway. It's a book about situationist theory and urban foraging and just my own kind of story of trying to engage in my community and engage with the spectacle.
Excellent. And how about your forthcoming fiction?
Okay, and my novel, which is coming out next year, is about May 1968. It's coming out from Tor. It is a story of a student at the University of Nanterre who's involved in the student strikes, and the story of Christopher Robin Milne, the real life Christopher Robin from the Winnie the Pooh stories. So, and not to go too far into it, but in situationist theory, there's another radical practice called detournement, where you take a media image and you put it into a new context. So in this story, the student at Nanterre takes the media image, which is Christopher Robin from the Pooh stories, and puts him, the real person, into May 1968 Paris. So he's derailing a media image, which is in this case an actual person, and who, because of that, is much more complicated than the Christopher Robin from the story books. Although the basis for this is I've read Christopher Robin Milne's actual memoirs, and he was a very interesting guy, a naturalist, and he was a bookstore owner, he was a book salesman in Devon, and he wrestled in his memoirs with his legacy as the Christopher Robin from the Pooh stories, and wrote about his relationship with his father. And So that's all kind of part of my book called Billy Moon 1968, and of course Billy Moon is another name that Christopher Robin went by when he was a boy.
All right, fascinating. Very interesting stuff. So if people are interested in following you and your work, what are some of the websites that can do that?
Well, dietsoap.podomatic.com is where you find my podcast. DouglasLane.com or DouglasLane.net is my blog and my personal website. From there you can find short stories I've written. And you can find blog entries about the Pick Your Battle book. And if you want to find my short story collection, which came out in 2006, that was called Last Week's Apocalypse, has about 15 short stories in it. And that's available at Amazon.com, and you can go to your public library and get it there too, probably.
Awesome. Well, again, extremely interesting conversation, and I'm looking forward to more in the future. So, Douglas Lane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.